Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for the Health Report and Explorations, coming up after As It Is.
Hello again and welcome back. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. Let's work together to learn some interesting information and improve our American English at the same time. Today, we talk about something that has changed our lives, and many of us wonder if we could ever again do without it. This year marks the 25th anniversary of the invention of the World Wide Web. What started as a way for scientists to share information has changed nearly everything. We will provide some history and then hear what may be the future for sharing huge amounts of information. It is nice to have you with us as we look at the world as it is. It all started in March of 1989. British scientist Tim Berners-Lee was working at CERN, the European Organization for Nuclear Research in Switzerland. Scientists would come to CERN from all over the world, but others could not see their research because of differences in computers. Tim Berners-Lee thought it would be easier if all the computers could talk to one another and exchange information directly. So he proposed linking the machines. His proposal would later become known as the World Wide Web. It took 2 years before researchers could successfully link a computer server and a web browser through the Internet. It would be officially launched in August 1991. By 1993, there would be more than 500 web servers. Now, there are more than 1.7 billion people on the web worldwide. James Hendler is the director of the Rensselaer Institute for Data Exploration and Applications in Troy, New York. Mr. Hendler spoke to VOA on Skype. He says one of the main issues slowing web growth has been the use of the English language in computer coding and on keyboards. He says that problem has been solved, and he thinks Asia can look forward to more and more web access.
In the U.S., we're at somewhere between 80 and 90% of people already having access, and, you know, not much growth. In China, you see about 25%, and of course, a country much bigger than ours. India, I don't know the current number, but again, a small number growing very quickly. So most of the growth we expect in the web will actually be in those parts of the world that don't yet have it.
Jim Hendler has worked on the World Wide Web since its early days. Paul Levinson is a professor of communications and media studies at Fordham University in New York. He says recent events have shown the power that the web has put in the hands of everyday people. He notes examples like the Arab Spring and the Occupy Wall Street movement. Professor Levinson spoke to VOA on Skype. He says the web is a tool that he considers unequaled in its reach and influence.
What we have now is a battle. On the one hand, the governments are more aware of these devices, and they are more aware of what used to be called and still could be called citizen journalism. But on the other hand, there are more smartphones out there than ever before. And I think so far, and this is good for democracy and the expression of human ideas, so far the people are winning.
25 years after its invention, billions of people now use the World Wide Web. But James Hendler of the Rensselaer Institute says only a small part of the web's potential has been realized.
Here is this force that has really changed society in so many different ways. we understand sort of the mathematics of the computer network underneath it and the engineering of that, but we really don't understand the social impacts. There's more and more research that's starting to study what are those different effects? How do they affect society? How do we build the web and keep it open and free? How do we really understand the impacts of this thing we call the World Wide Web?
Tim Berners-Lee went on to create the World Wide Web Foundation. The group says in its mission statement that it wants to establish the open web as a global public good and basic right. Okay, we think we understand the internet as it is today, but how might technology influence our lives 10 years from now? A recent study combined the imaginings or opinions of about 1,500 experts. The report was a project of the Pew Research Center and Elon University in the United States. Mario Ritter joins us with that part of the story.
Elon University professor Jana Anderson was one of the lead writers of the report. She says the experts generally agreed on the kinds of changes that would take place. But she says their ideas were very different when they described how those changes would influence internet users. Many of the experts said they believe that the internet would become less noticeable, but tied to daily life like electricity. The report said increasing the availability and use of the internet would produce more connectivity between people and machines. This connectivity, it says, will change everything from personal interactions to the decisions made by governments around the world. Many of the predictions are a sign of improvements in the future. But the experts also expressed concern. Pew Research and Elon University have been doing similar studies since 2004. Jana Anderson says excitement over technology has dropped somewhat over the past 10 years. In 2004, she says, most experts talked about all the good things that progress in technology would bring. Now, she says, there is more discussion about the negative results from the internet. Jana Anderson says, people are starting to realize that the power of communication can be used by anyone, good or bad. The experts told researchers the increasing reach of the internet will strengthen connectivity worldwide. And they said this could lead to more positive relationships among societies. The report noted that what some observers have called the Internet of Things will become more important. In the future, common devices, from coffee makers to electric toothbrushes, will be connected to the World Wide Web. The huge amount of information that all these devices produce will be linked with mechanical or artificial intelligence. This, the experts say, will make people more aware of the world and their own behavior. Other important devices will be the ones people wear to improve or augment reality. These devices can study your daily activities and provide suggestions. For example, they could provide suggestions to improve personal health. However, there were also predictions of increasing problems for the internet. Some experts noted that abuses and abusers involved in pornography, crime, and bullying will become an increasing problem. The report warned that governments and businesses could threaten internet freedom. And it says the idea of privacy will continue to disappear and be available only to those who have the ability to pay for it. The report, of course, is only a set of predictions. But Jana Anderson says that after examining thousands of predictions about the Internet, many of them proved to be right. I'm Mario Ritter.
And I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. Thank you for being a part of our world as it is on VOA.
The Health Report is next, followed by Explorations. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health Report. Could young blood be the answer to cheating death? It may sound like the story in a vampire movie, but now there is scientific research that supports the theory. U.S. scientists have discovered a protein in the blood in young mice that can undo some effects of aging in old mice. The same protein is present in human blood and might one day help us lead healthier lives. Two papers published in the journal Science discuss this protein called GDF11. Researchers at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts, explain how GDF11 improved the brain and muscle ability of older mice. This protein is found in high levels in the blood of young mice, and it appears to help develop new blood vessels. In one experiment, the scientists increased the levels of GDF11 in aging mice by surgically connecting the blood flow systems of young mice to the old mice. Blood containing higher levels of GDF11 flowed among both groups. In another experiment, they injected the protein into old mice. Scientists saw the greatest change in the old mice that shared blood flow with the young. The old mice formed new blood vessels. The animals' blood flow improved, and the aging process changed directions, or reversed, in every tissue the researchers observed. Researcher Lee Rubin is a professor of stem cell research at Harvard's Stem Cell Institute. His team looked at the effect of GDF11 on brain tissue.
So this simple surgery, infusing an old mouse with young blood, actually produced some structural changes in the old brain, making the old brain, in essence, more like young brain, and some people use the phrase rejuvenating the old brain. And similar things were observed in other tissues.
Rubin's teammate, Amy Wagers, said that GDF11 repaired DNA damage linked to aging. Wager said earlier GDF11 research showed a change in the weakened hearts of older mice. The hearts returned to a more youthful size and beat more efficiently. So this is great news for old mice, but what does it mean for us? There is growing hope that GDF11 might someday repair and renew unhealthy human hearts. Also, Mr. Rubin says the protein might improve memory power for Alzheimer's patients or physical movement for people with Parkinson's disease. But the researcher says the protein is not a fountain of youth. He says the aim of the research is not to lengthen life as much as to improve it.
In other words, even if you didn't live more years, at least you could remain healthier for the number of years you do live.
And that's the Health Report. I'm Anna Mateo.
From VOA Learning English, this is Explorations in Special English. I'm Jerry Watson.
And I'm Jim Tedder. Today, we visit a small museum in the American state of Maryland. It is called the National Cryptologic Museum. There, you will find information that was once secret.
The National Cryptologic Museum is on Fort George G. Meade, a military base near Washington, D.C. It tells the story of cryptology and the men and women who have worked in this unusual profession. The word cryptology comes from the Greek kryptos logos. It means hidden word. Cryptology is writing or communicating in ways designed to hide the meaning of your words. The museum has many examples of equipment that was once used to make information secret. It also has equipment that was developed to read secret messages. The method of hiding exact meanings is called coding. People have used secret codes throughout history to protect important information.
The National Cryptologic Museum celebrated 60 years of cryptologic excellence in 2012. One event there marked the 60th anniversary of the National Security Agency. Two former NSA workers shared their memories of operating a code machine called SIGABA. Many skills are needed to send and translate secret messages. The first and most important skill is knowing how to keep a secret. Helen Neubauer worked in Washington during World War II and for the United States military in Japan after the war.
The officers in charge of the code rooms would remind us constantly to keep our mouths shut. Don't even mention one thing about where a message came from, and certainly nothing it said. And they'd say, now, when you have a top secret clearance, that's what it means, top secret, keep your mouth shut. So we got reminded a lot.
The SIGABA machine made plain information a secret language to those who lacked the equipment to understand it. The one that Helen Neubauer operated was a complex device. The National Cryptologic Museum displays both early and modern tools that have been used in secret communications.
One display at the museum explains American attempts to read Japanese military information during World War II. Japan's Navy used special machines to change its written information into secret codes. This coded information was then sent by radio to Navy ships and military bases. The information included secret military plans and orders. The leaders of the Japanese Navy believed no one could read or understand the secret codes. They were wrong. Americans were working very hard to learn the Japanese code. The United States urgently needed to break the code to learn what Japan was planning.
Thank you. In 1940, an American woman named Genevieve Grochen found some information being repeated in Japanese coded messages. At the time, she was a civilian working for the government in Washington, D.C. Her discovery helped the United States understand secret Japanese diplomatic messages. After the United States understood the code, it was possible to study messages from the Japanese ambassador to Germany and to his supervisors in Japan. Understanding these messages helped the United States prepare for a possible war in the Pacific with Japan. Yet the United States was surprised by the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. The Japanese military did not send coded military information to the country's diplomats. Military messages used different codes.
After the attack on Pearl Harbor, an American naval officer named Joseph Rochefort struggled to understand the Japanese Navy code. He worked on the American base at Pearl Harbor. It was early in 1942. The American naval commander in the Pacific Ocean was Chester Nimitz. His forces were much smaller than the Japanese naval forces, and the Japanese had been winning many victories. Joseph Rochefort had worked for several months to read the secret Japanese naval code called JN-25. If he could understand enough of the code, he would be able to give Admiral Nimitz very valuable information. The admiral could use this information to plan for battle. By the early part of the year, Mr. Rochefort and the men who worked with him could read a little less than 20% of the Japanese JN-25 code.
From the beginning of 1942, the Japanese code discussed a place called AF. Joseph Rochefort felt the Japanese were planning an important battle aimed at AF. But where was AF? After several weeks, he and other naval experts told Admiral Nimitz that their best idea was that the AF in the Japanese code was the American-held island of Midway. Admiral Nimitz said he must have more information to prepare for such an attack. The Navy experts decided to trick Japan. They told the American military force on Midway to broadcast a false message. The message would say the island was having problems with its water processing equipment. The message asked that fresh water be sent to the island immediately. This message was not sent in code. Several days later, a Japanese radio broadcast in the JN-25 code said that AF had little water.
Joseph Rochefort had the evidence he needed. AF was now known to be the island of Midway. He also told Admiral Nimitz the Japanese would attack Midway on June 3rd. The admiral secretly moved his small force to an area near Midway and waited for the Japanese Navy. The battle that followed was a huge American victory. Experts now say the Battle of Midway was the beginning of the American victory in the Pacific. That victory was possible because Joseph Rochefort learned to read enough of the Japanese code to discover the meaning of the letters AF.
One American code has never been broken. Perhaps it never will. It was used in the Pacific during World War II. For many years, the government would not discuss this secret code. Listen for a moment to this very unusual code. Then you may understand why the Japanese military forces were never able to understand any of it. The code is in the voice of a Native American. The man you just heard is singing a simple song in the Navajo language. Very few people outside the Navajo Nation are able to speak any of their very difficult language. At the beginning of World War II, the United States Marine Corps asked members of the Navajo tribe to train as code talkers.
The Cryptologic Museum says the Marine Corps code talkers could take a sentence in English and change it into their language in about 20 seconds. A code machine needed about 30 minutes to do the same work. The Navajo code talkers took part in every battle the Marines entered in the Pacific during World War II. The Japanese were very skilled at breaking codes, but they were never able to understand any of what they called the Marine Code. 8 members of the Choctaw tribe were the first code talkers. They worked in teams during World War I using their native language that was unknown in Europe. A Choctaw would translate a message in English into his native language and send it by radio. Another Choctaw would receive the message and change it back to English.
The Cryptologic Museum has many pieces of mechanical and electric equipment used to change words into code. It also has almost as many examples of machines used to try to change code back into useful words. Perhaps the most famous is a World War II German code machine called the Enigma. The word Enigma means a puzzle or a problem that is difficult to solve. The German military used the Enigma machine to communicate orders and plans. The United States, Britain, and the government of Poland cooperated in learning to read information sent by the Enigma. It took thousands of people and cost millions of dollars to read the Enigma information. However, the time, effort, and money resulted in a quicker end to the war against Nazi Germany.
The National Cryptologic Museum belongs to the National Security Agency. One of the agency's many jobs is cryptography for the United States government. The work of the NSA is not open to the public. However, the museum tells the stories of the men and women who worked for the NSA long after their work is no longer secret. Each part of the museum shows the value of this secret, difficult, and demanding work. Visitors say it is very interesting and fun to see equipment and read documents that were once very important and very, very secret.
This program was written by Paul Thompson and Anka Decker. I'm Jim Tedder.
And I'm Jerry Watson. Join us again next week for Explorations in Special English on The Voice of America.